Good morning, everyone. Oh, I have something here for Paula at the end. Thank you. We're reading in book 6 of Savitri, and last week we finished canto 1. We finished our reading of canto 1. So today we'll make a start on canto 2. And usually we read the whole canto before we start studying it. But for the previous canto, we just read the first section and then we studied that. And then we went on to the next one. So I think that's what we'll do this time also. We'll read around the circle, the first section, which ends on page 442, and then we'll go back to the beginning. Page 437, we are starting. We can start here, Manoha.
Canto 2, the way of faith and the problem of faith. Silence sealed the irrevocable decree. The word of faith that fell from heavenly lips, fixing a doom no power could ever reverse, unless heaven's will itself would change its course. Or so it seemed, yet from the silence rose one voice that questioned changeless destiny, a will that strove against the immutable will, a mother's heart that heard the faithful speech that rang like a sanction to the call of death and came like a chill close to life and hope. Yet hope sank down like an extinguished fire. She felt the leaden inevitable hand invade the secrecy of her guarded soul and smite with sudden pain its still content and the empire of her hard-won quietude. A while she fell to the level of human mind, filled of mortal grief and nature's law. She shared, she bore the common lot of men and felt that common hearts endure in time.
Thank you. Larry.
Voicing Earth's question to the inscrutable power, the queen now turned to the still immobile seer, assailed by the discontent in nature's depths, partner in the agony of dumb, driven things, and all the misery, all the ignorant cry, passionate like sorrow questioning heaven, she spoke. Lending her speech to the surface soul on earth, she uttered the suffering in the world's dumb heart and man's revolt against his ignorant fate. O seer, in the earth's strange twi-natured life, by what pitiless adverse necessity, or what cold freak of a creator's will, by what random accident or govern chance that shaped the rule out of fortuitous steps, made destiny from an hour's emotion, came into the unreadable mystery of time, the dire mystery of grief and pain. Is it thy God who made this cruel law? Or some disastrous power has marred his work, and he stands helpless to defend or save. Fatal seed was sown in life's false start, when evil twinned with good on earthly soil. Then first appeared the malady of mind, its pang of thought, its quest for the aim of life.
Thank you. Akash.
It twisted into forms of good and evil, the frank simplicity of the animal's acts. It turned the straight path given by the body's gods, followed the zigzag of the uncertain course, applied that wanders seeking for its aim. In the pales starlight falling from the thought's cutters, it guides the unsure idea, the wavering will. Lost was the instinct, safe identity, with the soft arrow point of being's inmost sight. Marred the sure steps of nature's simple walk, and truth and freedom in the growing soul. Out of some ageless innocence and peace, privilege of souls not yet betrayed to birth, cast down to suffer on this hard, dangerous earth, our life was born in pain and with a cry. Although earth nature welcomes heaven's breath, inspiring matter with the will to live, a thousand ills assail the mortal's hours and wear away the natural joy of life. Our bodies are an engine cunningly made, but for all its parts, as cunningly are planned, contrived ingeniously with the demon skill, its apt, inevitable heritage of mortal danger and peculiar pain. Its payment of the tax of time and fate, its way to suffer and its way to die. This is the ransom of our high estate, the sign of stamp of our humanity.
Thank you. Ganga Lakshmi?
Yes. A greeting company of maladie. Come. Listen, lodges into man's body house. A warrior of death and torturer of life. In the malignant hollow of the world, in its subconscious cavern passage, a bush, the lie waiting their power to leap, surrounding with danger, to see the city of life, admitted into the citadel of man's day. The mind is forced, men are suddenly killed. Ourself within us little forces nurse. We make of our own enemies our guests, out of their holes. Like beads, they creep and new. The chords of the divine musicians live, till frail and dim, the music dies away, or crashing snaps with a last tragic note. All that we were is like a forced defeat. All that we strive to behold us like a dream, in the grey sleep of matters in Europe.
Thank you. And Richard?
Mind suffers, linked by the world's disharmony, and the unloveliness of humanity. A treasure misspent or cheaply, fruitlessly sold, in the bazaar of a blind destiny, a gift of priceless value from time's cost,
lost, or misplaced in an uncaring world. Life is a mountain mist, an art gone dry, a seeker in a dark and obscure place, an elongated warrior facing grateful loss, an imperfect worker given a basking path, an ignorant judge of problems, ignores me. Is heaven worth life? Reach, gloom, and see his gifts. His glorious outbursts feature out in mind. For nature's gifts to man are gospel grace. All works enough by its own objects. Error is the conduit of our mortal thoughts, and falsehood lies in the deep bosom of truth. Sin poisons with its vivid flowers of joy, or leaves the red scar burnt across the soul. Virtue is a grey bondage and a god. At every stage is laid for us a snare. Alien to reason and the spirit's light, our form of action from a darkness space, and ignorance and nature are our roots.
Thank you. You'd like to read now?
Agree the victor of primacy is the past account, the future's book of fate, the centuries find men's follies and men's crimes upon the countless crowns of nature's list, as if the world's stone was not enough. A crop of misery obstinately is sown by his own hand in the thorns of the cross. The vast increasing tragic harvest tree from old misdeeds buried by oblivious time. He walks by his own choice into this tree. This mortal creature is his own worst foe. His sign is an artificial object. He rancid asks for means to harm his kind. He slays his happiness and others' good. Nothing has he learned from time and his history, even as of old in the raw youth of time. When our ignorant reign on the highways of fate, old forms of evil cling to the warm soul. War making not the sweet smiling calm of life, battle and refine, healing and metaphor, are still the fierce pastimes of man's creative child. An idiot hour destroys what centuries miss, his wanton rays of insight have placed with the beauty and the greatness of his genius trust, and the mighty output of a nation's trust. All he has achieved, he drags to the crucified.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
His grandeur returns to an epic of doom and fall. His littleness crawls contempt through squalor and mud. He calls heaven's retribution on his head and wallows in his self-made misery. A past author of the cosmic tragedy. His will conspires with death and time and fate. His brief appearance on the alleviate earth ever recurs but brings no high result to this wanderer through the eon rings of God that shut his life in their vast longevity. His soul's wide search and ever-returning hopes pursue the useless orbit of their course in a vain repetition of lost toils. Across the track of soon forgotten lives. All is an episode in a meaningless day.
Thank you. Thank you.
Why is it all and therefore are we here? If to some being of eternal bliss it's our spirit's destiny to return, or some still impersonal hate, endless calm, since that we are and out of that we came. Whence rose the strange and sterile interludes, lasting in vain through interminable time. Who willed to form or foreign
fame.
Or fame a universe in the cold and endless emptiness of space? Or if these beings must be, and their brief lives, what need had the soul of ignorance and tears? Whence rose the call for sorrow and for pain? Or all came helplessly without a cause? What power forced the immortal spirit to birth? The eternal witness once of eternity, the deathless sojourner, mid transient scenes, he camps in life's half-lit obscurity, amid the debris of his thoughts and dreams. Or who persuaded it to fall from bliss and forfeit its immortal privilege? Who laid on it the ceaseless will to live? A wanderer in this beautiful, sorrowful world, and bear its load of joy and grief and love.
Thank you, Dana.
Or if no being watches the works of time, what hard impersonal necessity compels the vain toil of three living things? A great illusion then has built the stars. But where then is the soul's security, its voice in this circling of unreal suns? Or else it is a wanderer from its home, who strays into a blind alley of time and chance, and finds no issue from a meaningless world. Or where begins and ends illusion's reign? Perhaps the soul we feel is only a dream, eternal self a fiction sent in trance.
Thank you.
Like reading the newspaper.
Yes, this canto is about the way of fate and the problem of pain. That is all the problems that we face, we human beings. And Sri Aurobindo has introduced Savitri's mother in order that she can ask all these questions on behalf of all of us. And we shall see that Sri Aurobindo gives some answers through the mouth of Narad. They are helpful, illuminating answers, and they fit into the run of the poem. But I always feel that these are not Sri Aurobindo's final answers, that the final answers come in book 10. So it will take us some time to reach there. But anyway, it's very helpful to be made aware of the questions which we are asking more or less consciously ourselves, and to be given some answers. So we'll go back to the beginning.
Please correct me if I'm wrong. I feel that the whole of book Savitri is questions being answered or put at different levels. In this level is more...
It's our level.
Then we have, when she talks with death, and before when her father was going through his... I mean, at different levels we always have the same questions. Here are just the basics. We keep repeating and repeating, even if we live several lives. We still
it's as if we don't learn anything.
And also, consciously, history shows to us that we repeat words and useless, all this useless.
And it's as if we can't help
so
repeating.
It's really like newspaper. But then there are other levels. But it's still the whole fil rouge, or what is that? Fil d'union is this question that comes.
Yes, that's why Sri Aurobindo has written this book. This is why the mother calls it the supreme revelation of Sri Aurobindo's vision. But he reveals answers to us, yes, as you say, in different ways, on different levels, gradually through the book. Very near the beginning of the book, in Book 1, Canto 4, we have the secret knowledge, which in a way gives all the answers. It's like Sri Aurobindo Upanishad, giving all the answers. But like the Upanishads, it gives in a kind of compact and suggestive way things that he will then elaborate in more detail. And here the Queen has just asked this series of questions, and we will see that one by one Narad answers them.
I wonder whether people in general perceive what she is saying here in terms of, like, that we call these dark forces into ourselves, we open ourselves, we sort of, you know, call them as gifts, and they lead us to ruin. And do people perceive that?
People may not perceive it, but as soon as we begin to think about life, this is a question, no? Why do we do that? Mm-hmm. And why does it seem that we can't help doing it? This is very strange. And if we are souls, if, as the scriptures tell us, we've come from some divine state, how have we come here? Why has that happened? There are various theories about it. But, well, it'll get explored here. Yeah. And that's why it's interesting that Sri Aurobindo, we can say, if most of the story is following the legend more or less closely, here this is really been inserted. And it's also interesting to know that this is the last passage of Savitri which he worked on before he left the body in 1950. Here towards the end of the canto, we have the last lines that he added at that time. So maybe this is also significant. So let's go back to the beginning and we'll look in more detail at the sentences. Alice.
The way of fate and the problem of pain. The silence healed the irrevocable decree. The word of fate that fell from heavenly lips. Fixing a doom no power could ever reverse. Unless heaven's will itself could change its course. Or so it seemed. Yet from the silence rose one voice that questioned changeless destiny, a will that strove against the immutable will, a mother's heart that heard the fateful speech that rang like a sanction to the call of death and came like a chill close to life and hope. Yet hope sank down like an extinguished fire.
Thank you. What is this irrevocable decree? There's the word of fate that Narad has spoken, And he has said that in 12 months from this day, when this day comes back again, Satyavan must die. He can see into the future. He's a truth speaker. What he says happens. And at the same time, Savitri herself has accepted this. She has said, I'm not going to try to avoid this fate. Because now I know why my spirit came on earth, and who I am, and who he is I love. So all the attempts and the wishes of the bystanders to maybe change things are in vain. So this seems to be a doom that no power could ever reverse. This is fate. But then Sri Aurobindo adds a line. He says, unless heaven's will itself could change its course. So of course none of the people there present think that that's possible, but that's what actually happens. That heaven's will itself changes its course. That is what happens in the poem.
Well, what Narayan has prophesied gets fulfilled, but as he says, you know, what else shall be is written in his soul.
Yeah, that comes a little later in the canto, yeah. No? That he says, this is fate, nothing can change it, but maybe something else happens.
Well, I'd say that fate doesn't change, but there's another fate that's breaking, a better one.
And yet he's going, because we human beings protest at fate, we question fate, we want to change fate, he embodies this will in Savitri's mother. From the silence, everybody's in shock, rose one voice that questions changeless destiny. Why does it have to be like this? And there's a will, a human will, that strives against the immutable will of fate, of destiny, of the way things are.
And it takes a lot of energy.
Yes, I suppose it does. And it's interesting that it comes from a mother. Mothers all over the world are protesting like this. No? It's a mother's heart that has heard this fateful speech. And that seems to come. This is Savitri's speech. Yeah, that seems like a sanction, as if she's accepting this call of death. No? The mother protests. So Savitri's mother feels that all hope is lost. No? Hope sank down like an extinguished fire. So this is what comes next. Describes her feelings about it. Andres.
She felt the leaden, inevitable hand invade the secrecy of her guarded soul, and smiled with sudden pain, its still content, and the empire of her hard-won quiet. A while, she fell to the level of human mind, a field of mortal being with nature's law. She shared with the Lord the common blood of men, and felt what common heart can do in hand. Voicing the first question to the inscrutable power, The queen now turns to the still and mobile seer, assailed by the discontent in nature's depths, partner in the agony of dumb-driving things, and all the misery of the ignorant cry, passionate like sorrow, questioning heaven she spoke, bending her speech to the survey so unheard, she uttered the suffering in the world's dumb heart, and man's revolt against his ignorant fate.
Thank you. Anything to ask?
What is the surface soul?
The surface soul, yes. Yes. Shobindo explains in The Life Divine. We have an inmost soul, which is our true being here on earth. But it projects out of itself a surface soul. He calls it the soul of desire. It's the life soul in us. Mm-hmm. And it's perhaps what we often refer to as the ego. Yeah. It's that individual being that's projected from our deep inner being onto the surface to represent it in the course of a normal lifetime.
So it is that's the elements of the inner soul?
It's not a falsehood, but it's something distorted and surface, it doesn't see the deepest reality of things. So that's what most of us are living in most of the time, is our surface soul.
Isn't this describing her thing, her reaction?
Yes, it's...
And really not knowing or perceiving her daughters.
Yes. Yes, it's often like that, no? But he says she lends her speech. This is what she's expressing. No? She's uttering this suffering that's general in the world, in humanity. And she's uttering our revolt when we say it should not be like this. How can it be like this? Yes, Patty.
It's a kind of aspiration in a way. I think that's why it's called the soul. Mm. Because it is an aspiration for something better.
Yes.
But because it's going at it in the wrong way, going from the point of give me what I want instead of thy will be done. So that's what's the problem.
No, it's this surface soul is quite a force, actually, in the world, and not always a negative force. But it's because it's limited by our normal human consciousness. It's erring. It makes mistakes.
Since I heard the first step, no.
Mm.
I think Shrivino says the ego is the helper, ego is the bar. Mm. So first you have to gather together yourself as an ego, be an individuality. But then you have to surrender it. She's not at the second point yet.
And you notice that he again reminds us that she's quite a developed being, a wise person. She has won, she's made efforts to overcome the ordinary human nature. She's gained this hard-won quietude, no? And she's gained a sort of sattvic tranquility. But now this is too much, no, what has happened. And so she falls from that state. And she feels what ordinary people feel who haven't had the chance to make those efforts. So what does she ask, Mathilde?
Oh dear, in the earth strange clean nature like by what pitiless adverse necessity, or what cold freak of her creator's will, by what random accident or govern change that shapes a rule out of 42 steps, may destiny from an hour's emotion came into the unreadable mystery of time, the dearer mystery of grief and pain. Is it thy God who made this cruel law, or some disastrous power has made marriage in his words, and he stands helpless to defend our faith?
Thank you.
Oh, the word that was just read, into the unreadable mystery of time, the dire.
Yes, dire, terrible.
Yeah.
So this is the question. In this strange earth life, twi-natured, we live surrounded by dualities. We can't escape from the dualities. How has this mystery of grief and pain come? Time is already such a mystery. What is this? This succession of time, of moments, of apparent consequences, actions and results, that's in itself a mystery, unreadable mystery. How has come this more dreadful mystery of grief and pain? Is it the result of a pitiless, adverse necessity? A hostile necessity? The Greeks believed in something like that. They believed in a goddess, or actually there are four goddesses who are connected with necessity. And they preceded the Olympian gods. And they are faceless. Nobody knows what they look like, but they see everything. And when they enter the halls of the Olympian gods, those gods turn their faces away. They don't want to be seen by these goddesses. I think I can remember the name of three of them. There's Ananke. Ananke, that's necessity. And there's Moira, is fate. And there's Nemesis, which is the inevitable results of... Yes. But there's a fourth one, I've forgotten her name.
Hubris, what's the name of them all?
Sorry?
Hubris.
Hubris is what humans have. Hubris is the pride and overconfidence which brings about nemesis.
which was the name of the four goddesses together? I think they had the name of them together.
Well, they're sometimes called the Fates. The Fates. But the Fates, there are three Fates. So I don't know. Paula will have to look it up and tell us. Yes. So is there some kind of force in the universe which is a necessity, which is hostile to humanity and to everything that should be good? Or is there a hostile creator, a creator who doesn't care, who is cold and pitiless and unfeeling, who has just set things up like this? Is it an accident? Or is there something like chance which is governed, which is ruled in some way, that shaped a kind of law out of fortuitous steps, steps that happen by chance, that has created destiny from an hour's emotion? How has it happened? Is it thy God who made this cruel law? You're a worshipper of Vishnu, you're always singing about Vishnu and his love and his creative power. Is it he who has done this? Or is there some other power, some evil power, who has spoiled his work and he can't do anything about it? A lot of people believe something like that. They don't put it into so many words, but they feel that God can't be all powerful, otherwise things wouldn't be like this. And then she starts to describe how she's perceiving all this. You read.
A fatal seed was sown in life's false start, when evil twinned with good on earthly soil. Then first appeared the malady of mind, its pang of thought, its quest for the aim of life. It twisted into forms of good and ill, the frank simplicity of the animal's acts. It turned the straight path hewn by body's gods, followed the zigzag of an uncertain course, of life that wanders seeking for its aim. In the pale starlight falling from dark skies, it guides the unsure idea, the wavering will. Lost was the instinct's safe identity, with the arrow point of being's inmost sight, marred the sure steps of nature's simple walk, and truth and freedom in the growing soul.
Let's look at this. Sorry?
What is God?
What is God?
Your body is not your body, the body of the mother.
Oh, here he says the body is God's, yes. No, this is something very, very interesting. What she's saying, and to a certain extent it's true, that if we weren't so much dominated by our minds, our body would know what to do. Perhaps it's a digression, but still, To me it's interesting, so I will share it. There's a famous Chinese epic about the monkey. It's actually about Tripitaka, who was the Chinese monk who came to India to find the Buddhist scriptures, the authentic Buddhist scriptures. But the story of his pilgrimage, which actually happened, has been turned into a great epic poem. And in that story, the pilgrim on his way to find the truth is assisted by three servants. One of them is Monkey. And he's so clever and so powerful, but he only does mischief. And in order for him to help Tripitaka on this journey, he's given a special band around his head, which gives him a terrible headache if he doesn't stay a bit disciplined, you know. Otherwise, he's doing mischief all over the universe. The second helper is Piggy. Piggy. He's a pig, or he's like a pig. He wallows in the mud and he's got desires. So this is our vital being. And the third one is called Sandy. And the commentators on this epic, they find Sandy very mysterious. But according to me, Sandy is that, or the body's gods. They know in a way exactly what is right. They are down to earth. They are in touch with earth reality. And in several crucial points in the story, Sandy is very, very helpful. So, these three helpers have been very helpful to me at different times in my life, and that's why I like this story. But I think that's what perhaps he's referring to here. That down-to-earthness of the body, when it's not distorted, when it's not misled by Piggy or pushed about by Monkey.
What is Monkey's name?
He's just called Monkey.
In Chinese, I learned Japanese, we call it Son Ogong.
Hmm? Son Ogong. Son Ogong, yes.
In Korean, but the Chinese level use the term Ogong. Japanese,
I think. I've seen pictures or statues of it. The monkey is leading, the monk is on oxen, riding behind them, behind them the two others. Whatever that means.
It's a very popular idea in the West. Listen to your body, you know, and all the exercise classes and all that. But I have a vague idea that there's a planet and a deity who governs every organ of the body. Somehow I have this idea, but I haven't researched it to check it out. I think I read that somewhere.
So, but that's what she's saying here, no? That it's the malady of mind. That's what has gone wrong. First of all, she says there's a fatal seed was sown at the beginning of life in which evil and good somehow are born together. And then when mind comes, this develops into our dualities. We, with our mind, we twist into forms of good and ill the frank simplicity of the animal's acts. We can't make moral judgments about what animals do, although in the case of our pets, we try to. We train them. We give them dogs develop a moral sense because of us. But otherwise, the animal's acts are just frank and simple. It does what it has to do. So the mind has also turned the twisted, these straight paths that are cut through by the body's gods, the body that knows just exactly what has to be done for its good. And then there's this zigzag course of life that is not following the body's God's straight path anymore, but is wandering, looking for its aim in the pale starlight falling from false skies. Our life impulses are influenced by this pale starlight. Life is guided by the unsure idea and the wavering will that thinks now this is good and now that is good. So that safe identity which life has at the instinctive level, with the arrow point of being's inmost sight, the instinct of what should be done, has to be done. This has marred, this has spoiled and distorted the sure steps of nature's simple walk. And this has very much interfered with the truth and freedom in the growing soul. So here she blames mind.
This is exactly how I facilitate go on.
That mind interferes.
That mind interferes and that follows the body. Is that what you mean by mischievous mind?
In the story, he's mischievous because he's unreliable. He interferes in the way the gods have organized things. He goes and steals the peaches of immortality from the... This is interesting. It means that mind is a tremendous power. And if it is disciplined and if it follows the right path, then it can be very, very useful. In Canto 10, I think it is here, of Book 2, Sri Aurobindo says that the gods use the powers of mind to arrange things the way they should be. But if it's undisciplined, as it very often is, and then I think, again this is my own connection, but I think our monkey, our Hanuman, this is the mind that's absolutely devoted to Lord Rama. So he's also mischievous sometimes, but he's got his guiding light and his guiding.
But this instinct idea, I think it can be distorted. I know Mother tells the story about the monkey that was given the alcohol.
Yeah, well, who did that? It's the human beings who distort nature's simple walk. Otherwise the monkey would never have touched the alcohol, and the goat would never have eaten the molasses and killed itself, and so on.
But I've seen in Pondi that the cows, eating out of the garbage bins, things that aren't good for it.
Yes.
And also the dogs don't look healthy because people are feeding them all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
And the squirrels at Samadhi, someone is fond of feeding them chapatis and things like that. The natural food is the
flowers.
So I pile them up there for them to eat that, but sometimes they're not there. So man has this thing, he just wants to put his way on the little creatures for some reason. Why is that?
That's what she's asking. What has gone wrong? Why are we like that?
We like pets. We like pets.
Well, that in itself is not wrong, to love animals and to like to be close to them.
We twist them and turn them and make them do what
we want. We can't help that, because we are mental beings, and in us evil is twinned with good, and we've somehow lost this straight way, and that's why in us also there's an impulse to get back to nature, to get back to some simpler kind of way. But that also doesn't work. So the only thing that we can do is to get in touch with a higher consciousness. And that's actually what you want your art students to do. It's not that they just do instinctive scribbles, like, I mean, elephants do quite nice instinctive scribbles, no? But we want to make art. We want to make ourselves channels for a higher creative force.
I've got an illustration of that. Someone came to me last week and they wanted to draw, so I sent them out this stuff. And they came back and they had drawn a plant with hearts, because all the leaves were shaped like hearts, but they didn't relate to each other. And so all I had to do is go out and show her, look, you're not relating these leaves. And they became all different. And she said, oh.
So there's a process. Anyway, let's not get stuck here. Yeah? Because then she makes this another question. No? All this has happened, there's this distortion. How has it come about? Who is next there on the back row? Yes.
Out of sin, ageless, innocent, and peace, privilege of selves, not yet betrayed to birth, cast down to suffer on this hard, dangerous earth. Our life was born in pain and in regret. Although earth nature welcomes heaven's birth, inspiring matter with the will to live, a thousand years we save the mortal's hours and wear away the natural joy of life. Our bodies are an engine cunningly made, but for all its parts has cunningly of them, contrived ingeniously with demon skill, its act inevitable heritage of mortal danger and peculiar pain, its payment of the tax of time and fate, its way to suffer and its way to die. This is the ransom of our highest fate, the sign and stamp of our humanity, the grisly company of maladies. Come, listen, lodgers, into man's bodily house, purveyors of death and torturers of life.
Thank you. Allowed to lodge. They have a license, these maladies. We allow them. But what she's asking is, or referring to, is our sense of fall. But out of some ageless innocence and peace, that is our true natural original state. We've been cast down. Have we been condemned? That ageless innocence and peace is the privilege of souls that have not yet been betrayed to birth. They've not yet, something seems to have gone wrong, a betrayal. No? So here we are just thrown down to suffer on this hard and dangerous earth. And the sign of that is that our life is born in pain and with a cry. It's interesting that nowadays they have found that it needn't be like this, you know, that the mothers don't need to suffer so much and the babies don't need to cry when as soon as they are born. So perhaps that's the mark of some kind of change in our attitude to life.
You're talking about the loss of mother opting for cesarean?
No. I'm talking about some gynecologists have found ways of preparing mothers for the birth, and then particularly if they are ready to opt for a water birth, that's easier for them and the children. But mostly it is what happens as the birth happens. Now for I don't know how long women have been going into hospital and to clinical environments where men are in charge, doctors and authoritarian nurses, and things are done in a way that suits those hospital staff. But it doesn't have to be like that. I think there's one French gynecologist in particular who has pioneered this painless birth, and there are beautiful photographs in his book of babies just a few minutes after birth smiling ecstatically. This really doesn't have to be in pain and with a cry. I think his name is Lamez. Yes, they're here in Oroville. We try in this direction.
I'm supposed to get them to breathe. That's, I think, the original idea.
Yes, but they don't have to. If you don't cut the umbilical cord, the mother can hold the baby on her breast until it begins naturally to breathe, and then you can cut the cord, and there's no trauma, nothing. Sorry, we're really digressing today.
But it's good.
But Shandavan, I want to tell you what Mother said in Shandavan 1970. She said, the nature, the mother nature accepts his robe.
Accepts what?
La robe.
Yes.
Accept de porter sa robe.
Yes.
1970. Alors now is 2015.
To wear mother's robe.
Yeah. She very, very, yes. He touched me incredibly. Yes. He touched something. Your experience after that is incredible. But the mother nature changed.
Yes, she's given a message even, that nature has accepted to collaborate,
exactly.
And we shall see a change. Yes.
But it's especially about false perversion and repair. Was described in the beginning what he suffered in the body in 1970, starting with some very, very deep change in his cell. It is incredible. Alors, I understand. Before I read notes, but now something understand in my nature also.
Yes.
It's very, very. I am incredibly happy when I read about Mother Nature. I want to put the robe of the mother. I understand.
The mother's power of Ananda is here since 1946, Mother said. So she wants to eliminate all the suffering of every type on earth.
But she said textile, is not.
Yeah, naturally.
You have a lot of.
Well, because we are doing something ourselves, because of the mind, because of the action of the mind and the heritage of the mind, then we.
People have to stop thinking like the queen here. I was just wondering, where she got these philosophies, where she got this idea. Where she she had some guru who told her life is like this, or she...
No, this is observation. This is observation. She says, nature, earth nature welcomes heaven's breath. Yes, Andra.
I have a question regarding this topic. Sharon is trying to explain why humans have to suffer pain. Why are we so distorted and strange? So the question is, if somewhere there's an answer also, when would we came? Because maybe we were not that being since we...
Yes, that's what she's saying, no? Yeah. It seems to happen when we are born. Why does it have to happen then, no? But
also as a species, since we were Homo sapiens, we were distorted? I think not. Yeah. At some point in human history, we...
So, Narad gives an answer to this question later on. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Isn't one of our great problems, all humanity that I've ever met know, we have very strong desires, sometimes very bad ones that are greedy, and the frustration of not having these desires not having the desire satisfied or satisfied in a bad way makes us suffer. Isn't that one of the major sources of suffering there? Is that what we want? We don't get.
I don't think this is the major source.
Oh, I think man not living according to Dharma even affects the weather. You know, I have noticed how the weather is improving here, becoming more gentle and amazingly so. Since the cyclone punished us, and after that, everything...
Kindness is coming.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, the government of a country...
Have you noticed how much we like drama?
That is what we discussed before. That is the worst thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's creating. But when people aspire for harmony and peace, then.
Yeah, that is part of the Indian tradition, no? That if people live according to Dharma, then the rain will fall. And the crops will grow, and things will be. And so that is the sign of the excellence of a king, that everything prospers in his kingdom. And unfortunately, in India, more in the Middle Ages or more recently, they've decided that if the weather is wrong and the crops don't grow, it's the fault of the ascetics. They are not doing their jobs properly.
Oh,
you know, so, yeah.
Are there ascetics in California right now?
I suppose, anyway.
Here it says that ageless innocence and peace, is this just a default state of the psychic being before taking birth?
That's what she's saying.
Yeah, and in that case, you know, I heard some guru was telling somebody else, you know, somebody told that this guru believes that the default state of human being is soft, sadness. I tend to disagree with that.
Absolutely.
But I wonder what would be our default state of human being?
The Upanishad says it is ananda. Ananda. From that we come and to that we go.
From joy to joy.
What is ananda?
What is ananda?
Ananda is the divine state of bliss, which comes from pure existence, pure consciousness. They're connected. So sometimes we say, from light we come, to light we go.
And it's delight in everything here, right now, not just after, just in the body.
I think part of the thing that brings the problem is with the mind. That it can always see different possibilities. So it says, you know, oh, what if it was like this? Or what if we do it this way? Or what if I do this? Or what if I do that instead? So it can always keep seeing all different kinds of possibilities. And so instead of kind of going the natural path, it's always looking at all these different options.
Monkey mind.
Yeah.
That's an aspiration in a way, but the thing is, it comes back to the same thing again. We have to surrender to the divine's will. That's the big lesson.
That's the key.
But I was thinking the other, what you said about peace, you know, we had a program the other day in Ashram on Japan. So they had taken these beautiful photos and then of the landscapes, and then they went to Hiroshima. So of course they had the Dome of Peace, you know, and all that. And it was an uncanny thing. They said it reminded them of the Mata Mandir, with this big building in which there are 12 pillars and all that. But there's no ray of light coming in. Has anyone been to this place in Japan, in Hiroshima? So anyway, what I was thinking is that some people's definition of peace is just no nuclear war. I mean, you know, we have to look at it more carefully, because as Larry is telling, it's all in the mind. So with that peace of mind, then of course anything like nuclear war would be totally impossible. But I think we're not looking deep enough to see. She doesn't have any concept, this queen, she doesn't have a concept of
peace of mind,
I think.
No, she had it. She had that. She had this hard-won quietude. But why is it we can reach a sattvic state, live a sattvic life, and something can happen and disturb our whole balance because the basic problem is not solved?
What is the basic?
So that's what we're going to find out.
Putting all that down, not just your manual labor to do.
We're doing here. We're not.
Anyway, it's 11:45 already. Shall we stop there with this grisly company of maladies? We let them in somehow. If the mind were pure, if the mind were open to higher states, then perhaps we wouldn't have to have this grisly company of maladies.
The mind is also a problem, isn't it?
Yes, everything. It's the central problem.
Grisly is such a good word to stop.
So you will play us, Mother, reading a few passages.
What line actually did you stop?
I think we stopped at line 74. Well, what we have Mother reading, of course, doesn't have to do with the questions. It is to do with the answer. So I think we'll just hear the first two. Enormous damn
has opened the door of his undoing. How shall he cure the ills he never sent? He carries the suffering world in his own flesh.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.
This gynecologist who has a wonderful way to avoid pain and anything. Where did you get that from, the source?
Sorry?
You talked about a gynecologist who had the way of making...
Yeah, Tara knows about him.
Huh? Is there an article or something?
There's a book. It must be in Laboratory of Evolution.
I'm going out next Sunday.
Yes.
For 2 weeks. And I'm going to be joining with my the person who made it possible for me to come back to India. And she kept me keep the faith. She helped me keep the faith. So I'll take the book with me.
Yes.
Love you too with me. I'll see you after June.
Okay. Thank you. This?
I find this in the toilet. I don't know.
Give to Suresh, he can hold it outside. Anybody's lost this?
It's in the toilet.
Here or the...
Sorry, I couldn't come. Baby is born. Very nice little... Oh, it's not a very little baby. A boy.
A boy?
Yeah.
Oh.
We all thought... Even me, I was convinced it's a girl. And I was always thinking about a girl. And then it was a boy. Okay. That's how it has to be. And his name is Shibi.
Shibi.
This was a...
Famous king.
Yes. And for the for the character of this king, who always gave when somebody came to give him, he chose this name. He has also two others, Shiva, and the last one I forgot because it's too complicated for my little head.
One of those Tamil names.
I hope he comes up to this name.
Nice.
But he's very nice little boy. So
that's what I thought. I thought the baby must be being born.
And also, you know, I'm with a bicycle. It's raining. So sometimes I can
and muddy. Take care.
Well, yeah, that's okay. I go to big roads and I don't go to small roads. And how are you?
I'm fine.
You have news from your husband? Because
he phoned
you
yesterday.
Were worrying.
No. Everything's fine.
Everything is fine. So nice
He's
day.
In Berlin now.
Ah, in Berlin. I go there when I go back. Bye-bye.
Take care, stay. I'm going to spend a little time with these people. Yes? Oh, you are leaving? Yes. What did you do? You broke your arm. You fell down.
Came a motorbike on my cycle.
Oh, dear. Oh dear. So, but you will be back.
Yes, October.
In October. And these sessions are supposed to appear on the website. They are not appearing yet, but they will. Have you got the address of the website?
Then we can follow it.
If you feel like.
Yes, I never know where and where you are.
Yeah, as yet they are not there, but they are supposed to be there.
That means you want to record them?
They are recorded. This is recorded.
Thank you so much.
That's why I was coming to thank you for...
Thank you. Good, more work.
There's almost 300 pages.
Okay.
So we'll give it to you one by one.
No problem. Good, I'm happy for that. So I always enjoy hearing you talk about childbirth. I didn't say anything.
I shouldn't have dared to say anything in your presence.
I just wanted to say something about the queen. I read about her in there. She was a mother of Kshatriyas, so she was a fighter.
That's why
she gave birth to a whole race of warriors.
But there's a very interesting,